This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. Every other week this fall, we'll be airing a rebroadcast of some of my favorite episodes from our archives. This week, we're featuring two supernovas from the world of classical music, acclaimed soprano Renee Fleming and the reigning virtuoso of the violin, Itzhak Perlman. First, my interview with Itzhak Perlman from 2019. This is Itzhak Perlman's exquisite vibrato on Bach's first violin sonata. He was mature by the time he made this recording, 30 years into a career that started before his bar mitzvah. Perlman doesn't like the word prodigy, but it's hard to avoid. At three, he was practicing scales on a toy violin. At four, he was studying with a great master. At 13, he was whisked away from his native Israel to the United States to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. He won admission to Juilliard that same year. From prodigy to master, and finally national treasure, for 60 years, his life was a blur of world tours and TV specials, playing for the Queen, and given a place of honor on the program for Obama's inauguration. Yet Itzhak Perlman had a difficult childhood. Stricken by polio in the war-torn early days of Israeli statehood, now he gives back at every opportunity, including through the Perlman Music Program. Founded by his wife Toby, the summer school is located on idyllic Shelter Island, giving talented kids of every background the chance to study with the world's greatest musicians. You'll meet Toby and a couple of former students at the end of the program. You'll even hear the students play a virtuoso movement from Mendelssohn's Octet. The whole crew join me live on stage at the NYU Skirball Center in Greenwich Village.
I always ask people who have a career similar to your career, if you understood...
They have careers similar to my career?
Well, not really. Actually, no.
Really?
There aren't many. There aren't many. But anybody who was a young person, who, especially in this world you're in, where they cultivate them very young, and in sports too, where they get these kids when they're 10 years old, and they kind of know that they're heading to the NBA or the NFL or whatever. But you're a very young child, and I'm wondering, do you know what you're going through when you're a young child, or you're too busy doing it to understand what you're inside of when you're getting shot through this rocket to become this famous
musician? When I was young, my parents thought that I had a good ear because I could repeat everything, you know, by singing it. And then I said I want to play the violin, and I think they told me that I had a nice sound. So that was the, if you want to call it the unusual thing about the way I played, I had a nice sound.
You were playing on what? Didn't you have like a toy violin? Or
well, I started with a toy, which I didn't like, so I quit that. And then I was playing on something. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't anything spectacular.
How old were you?
I started really when I was like almost five, four and three quarters, almost 5 years
old. Do you know why? What made you do that?
I wanted. I liked the sound. I loved the sound of the violin. I heard it on the radio. And I said, that's what I want to do. Simple. That's what I want to do. And there was no explanation. You know, everybody has a different thing that they hear, and it sort of grabs their imagination.
Yeah.
And the violin sound was that. And I think it was Heifetz, so he was pretty good for grabbing the imagination, you know.
At what age do you start to get a little tougher with them when they're how old?
Well, look, everybody has their own sort of schedule of development. You know, sometimes you hear somebody at the age of 12 who just sound basic, not very, very good. But you hear something there. And so you have to know what to say and what not to say. I'd like to just insert that. You know, what's the great secret of a good teacher is not only knowing what to say, but knowing what not to say. And especially what not to say when somebody that has great gift and great musical naturalness.
And those that have that great gift and that natural
ability. You
leave
them alone.
You do.
You leave them alone.
You don't want to hurt their feelings.
No, you don't want to hurt them. No, it's not their feelings. It's you don't want to futz around. You know, you don't want to, you know, just let the natural ability, the natural talent develop. And usually things get better as you grow older, you know, without having to really nitpick with everything. And that's I find is a danger, because you know, when a teacher has such incredible talent in front of them, you know, they want to give you their all, so then they become too picky. Leave it alone.
During what years did you study with Goldgart?
I studied with her from the age of 5 until I was 13.
You studied with her for 8 years.
8 years.
And then you came to the United States,
right,
to do Sullivan when you
yep.
were 13 years old.
Yes.
Now when you came to do Sullivan, I find that unbelievable. When you came to do Sullivan and you're 13 years old,
yes.
Did you have any idea who Sullivan was? This was your first
Absolutely
trip to the U.S.?
Absolutely
not. I had no idea.
I
was some weird
no
guy
idea.
With like you shoe know, polish again, in his hair.
Exactly. No, yeah. I didn't know how he looked or anything. I just in Israel, they talked about, because when we came to Israel to audition a whole bunch of people to go on his show, they said there they didn't call him Sullivan. They called him Sullivan.
Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan. Heard of Ed Sullivan. Who is Ed Sullivan? I don't know Ed Sullivan. Oh, television. Oh, my. Oh, I said, okay, television. I said, the minute I heard television, said, I'm in. So I auditioned, you know, and then I was chosen. You know, there was
sent people over to audition musicians
yes.
in Israel for
oh,
Sullivan?
Yes, because
for Sullivan?
Ed Sullivan wanted a show only of the Israeli, pardon my accent, only of the Israeli people. So it was a variety.
He was a great Jew, Ed Sullivan, wasn't he?
Yes.
Going back to the homeland, bringing the kids over.
Well, there some people thought his name was Ed Sullivan, but we changed it to Ed Sullivan.
It might have been.
But you know, so the whole show was an Israeli variety show. You've seen his show. You know, he had everybody. He had a monkey dancing, and then he had somebody playing the violin and so on. In this particular case, it was a pair of folk singers, and there was...
Topo Gigio.
We didn't have Topo, and
no,
we didn't
Topo,
have Gigio.
Okay.
We didn't have them. But we had a ballet dancer who was 14. We had a coloratura soprano from Yemen. I think I was in the department of human interest story or chubby story. I don't know what I was, but I was cute, I think, sort of.
You were very cute.
I was cute. Thank you so much.
Oh my
Thank
God,
you.
You were so cute. I've
Thank
seen
you.
The footage.
I know. I was
so when you
so
come
cute.
Over, you'd never been to the U.S. before.
No.
Your mother comes with you.
Yes.
And you perform on Sullivan.
Yes.
Do you remember what that was like doing the show?
It was slightly exciting. I didn't know. No, it was very exciting, you know. And so I kind of played, and it was over very quickly, you know, because I did the last movement of the Mendelssohn Concerto, and they cut it down to about, I think, 2 minutes and 45 seconds, because that was it. And he introduced me. He was a lovely gentleman, really very, very nice.
And then what happened after you did Sullivan?
We went on a tour.
In the U.S.,
oh, the entire group that did Sullivan, we went on a tour.
For how long? Months?
About three or four months.
Around
you know?
The country?
Yeah. yeah.
And at the end of that tour,
and at the end of the tour, I went. The main thing, the challenge was to get into the Juilliard School, and that was one of doing it.
Was that a plan for you to go to Juilliard?
Yes.
When you were back in Israel before Sullivan, that had always been in your sights.
Before Sullivan, it was a dream to go to Juilliard, but Sullivan made it.
But you were aware of Juilliard.
Yes, right. I was aware of Juilliard, and there was a teacher there who taught Juilliard that I heard about in Israel by the name of Galamian, and so we said one of these days maybe you'll study with
Galamian.
Him. So, Galamian, yeah. Ivan Galamian. Yeah. Yes. His assistant at that time was Dorothy DeLay, and she came and heard me play. And she thought that I had a good chance.
You had a good sound.
I had a good sound, you know. That was my forte, is the sound.
By then you were how old? 14?
No, no, 13 and a half, 14,
so
yeah.
So right around the same Sullivan period.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you? You'd never lived in New York. I mean, again, this idea of being like shot out of a cannon to have this spectacular career, this big ticket career. You're 13 years old, you're on Sullivan, you're touring the country, you're going to go to Juilliard. What was your recollection of that? Was it intimidating, or you don't have time to think about that?
I didn't really think about it because it wasn't really... look, it wasn't like a professional career. It was a specialized career, you know. In other words, to play for it was an Ed Sullivan concert. It wasn't like I was playing a recital someplace, you know, or I was making my debut in Carnegie Hall or anything like that. It was a specialized kind of concert, you know. And I used to play for Jewish benefits, you know, for the UJ. And they knew about me, you know, because the whole organization, the Jewish organization, knew about this Sullivan program. So they used some of the people for fundraising. And I was, you know, sometimes I would be called at the telephone. I would be hired to do 15 minutes or 10 minutes at the end of the fundraising, you know. And I would appear probably like 11 o'clock at night. You know, and I would play the Nigun by Bloch and the Flight of the Bumblebee, and that was it. And then I would leave, and I would get paid, you know, and it was great. You know, I played while the people were eating their desserts and of kosher food and things like that.
So. And was it the same people? Like one night you do Flight of the Bumblebee, and somebody says, he was better at Jerry's bar mitzvah. So much better.
I never did bar mitzvahs.
No, you didn't.
I never did bar mitzvahs, and I didn't
just
do
UJ.
And I didn't do weddings.
No weddings?
No weddings. Absolutely, you know.
Now, when you leave and you come to the United States, when you left for the Sullivan trip, was it assumed you were going to go home, or did you kind of know?
No, you knew
you weren't going home.
No, I knew that I was going to stay.
You were going back.
I was going to stay.
Really?
And,
what happened? Where'd your dad go?
My dad stayed for about a year in Israel and finished selling the apartment and doing the business, and then he came and joined us. Yeah, I even remember, you know, I did not see my dad for a year. And the only way to get in touch was through letters. And then a bit later on, you know, maybe after about 5, 6, 7, 8 months, we actually were able to arrange for a long distance call from New York to Tel Aviv, you know. And at that time, so you're talking about 1958, 59. So it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, and the phone rings. And I thought, hello? I said, hello? And that was the connection. You know, that was the connection. And, you know, we had...
I'm going to cry.
Absolutely. And we had in our street where I lived, we had no phone. So what we had was there was a grocery store that had a telephone. So whoever wanted to make a long distance call would go to the grocery store and would pick up. So that's what it
but
was.
But you knew you were going to stay.
Yes, yes. I learned the language from watching TV and, you know, listening to Yankee baseball.
You spoke very little English.
Well, no, hardly. I took a class of English in Israel. I think I failed. But it's amazing how quickly you learn, you know, when you hear the language around you all the time.
And you went to Juilliard, what, for how many years?
Let's see, until I think 19 or, I was 19 or 20, I think.
So 4 years.
Because I remember doing concerts and having to go to class. And, you know, sometimes I was late to a class and I got hell to pay, you know, because I just took a flight from Los Angeles. Give me a break, you know. So, no, but you didn't go to English class. You know, you have to be there. So, but I was, you know, so I did both things for a while. And then I graduated.
And where do you think your sound comes from?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. it's something that I hear.
You had polio when you were how old?
I had polio when I was 4 3/4.
Do you find that music become, you imbue that with even more of your being and your spirit because you were limited in the things you could do as a child?
No. I don't think so.
I'm getting everything wrong with you, aren't I?
Everything.
But it's going, good. No, that's not it. No.
But
no.
You're batting a
Actually,
thousand.
No.
That's good.
No.
But you're doing good. You know, I mean,
thank
because
you.
I, you know, no, it's no, seriously, I don't think so. I mean, I couldn't say to you, well, let me see how I'm playing without the polio. And now let's see how I'm playing with the polio. I can't say that.
I'm wondering if you, that okay.
Sorry, I'm giving you such a hard time, so I'm so sorry.
No, I mean, I knew this was coming. I've been around you a few times. It's always an obstacle course. But anyway, but what I'm saying is that do you think the spirit of the person, is that relevant? No.
I don't know. I love to watch people who are famous, like whether they're actors or people in sports, and sort of try and guess what kind of people they are in private. You know, and being good and being a wonderful person and being a sort of an agreeable, simpatico kind of person is not necessarily together. You know, I remember my wife always, you know, sometimes we go to a concert and we hear somebody who is absolutely amazing. And I say, Toby, come on, let's go backstage and say hello. And she says, I'd rather not. You know, I don't want to be disappointed. I love the way this person plays.
I know,
let's not do it. Let me just relax and just enjoy it.
Many people who conduct, and I'd love to get your opinion of this, many people who conduct are people who have good careers as a soloist. They play typically the violin or the piano. But they don't necessarily have great careers. But someone taps them on the shoulder and says, oh, you keep time very well, and they move them on. No, but I mean every one of them I would talk to would say that to me. I'd say, Dutoit, this one. They'd say, somebody walked up to me when I was like 10 years old and said, you keep time very well. Yeah. And they moved them into the conducting program, what have
you. I thought they moved into the viola section. I mean,
That's our ad for the show, right?
No. I must tell you that viola jokes are no longer applicable because the level of viola playing has really risen, seriously. So that you said
viola... What do you attribute that to?
No, it's really viola jokes. You know, it used to be that the level was a little bit below, but right now it's brilliant. I mean, so many brilliant viola players. Wow. So that it's not... But it's still funny, you know, so...
Violin legend Itzhak Perlman has a special place in his heart for the New York Philharmonic. He and then music director Alan Gilbert teamed up for the Phil's opening gala a few years ago.
Here comes our guest soloist, Itzhak Perlman, followed by music director of the New York Philharmonic, Alan Gilbert.
Gilbert found out he got the job from the Phil's president, Zarin Mehta, after a particularly miserable bedtime for his toddlers.
We had had a torturous night, and they had finally fallen asleep, and I got a call from Zarin Mehta just after they had fallen asleep. And he said, I'd like to invite you to be our next music director. And I said, my kids just fell asleep. I can't talk to you now. But
oh my God.
Then I called him back, and we had a
I want to put that scene in a movie where a guy's like, more than being the music director of the Philharmonic, I want my kids to go to sleep.
Yeah,
click.
Totally.
We all know the madness of that moment.
Yeah.
The rest of my conversation with conductor Alan Gilbert at heresthething.org. Coming up, Itzhak Perlman on Alan and Gilbert's art, what makes a great conductor, plus his wife Toby Perlman on their music school, and the next generation of great masters takes on Mendelssohn and my questions.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Itzhak Perlman didn't bring his famous Stradivarius. He says playing takes more effort now than it used to.
As you get older, everything becomes more difficult and more demanding.
And, really?
Oh, are you kidding me? but, you know, if you do a great piece, you can do it over and over again. Right. And no matter how, for me, a perfect example is the Beethoven Violin Concerto, which is not getting any easier as you get older. But it's very, very difficult when you're young as well.
It's tough.
I call it when my students start the piece, I say, welcome to the lifetime journey, because that's what it is. You know, you start to play and it's pretty good. And then you play it again, and you play it again, and you just grow up with it. So that's what music is about. And the minute you think musically like that, especially when you repeat something, you're on the right track. Instead of saying, oh, I have to do that again. No, but, you know, you have to look at the music, and you have to say, this is going to be yet another experience. It's going to be one way or another way, but it's not going to be a repetition of what I did a week ago or a month ago.
When you want to sit down, assuming that you do this, I don't want to assume, but when you want to listen to someone else play the violin that you admire and you admire their sound, give us an example of somebody you listen to. Who's a violinist you love?
For pure tone, the first person that comes to mind is Fritz Kreisler. You know, you listen to old recordings of hymns, and you think, you know, those days, there wasn't the great advancement in technology and so on. It's that you hear scratches, you hear the tone, and you say, oh my God, that is something unbelievable. Or Menuhin had a fantastic sound. I mean, everybody had a different kind of sound, but sometimes sounds, it's apples and oranges, you know. I mean, but that the first person that I hear of that kind of sound is his.
You conduct?
Yes.
And when did that begin and why?
It began, I tell you, it's very funny. It began with the Perlman Music Program. My wife, who started this whole thing, she said to me, we're going to have a string orchestra. Could you coach them? So I didn't think of myself as a conductor. I thought of myself as a coach, so I picked up a pencil and conducted with a pencil, you know, because if you conduct with a baton, you're a conductor. With a pencil, you're more of a teacher, you see that thing. And anyway, so that's actually when it started. And I got some, interesting, again, I got some nice sounds from the orchestra. Conducting, I find very mysterious, you know, because you can have four or five conductors who are absolutely excellent, and each one gives you a downbeat, and the orchestra will sound different with each one.
What do you attribute that to?
I have no idea, thank God.
What do you think makes a good conductor?
Oh, well, obviously knowing the score and knowing all of this thing. But in the final analysis, there is a mystery as to what makes somebody conduct a phrase and the orchestra play a certain way. I don't understand that. You know, a great conductor should understand what he or she wants to hear from the orchestra. So if I do, let's say, a Beethoven or a Brahms symphony, what do you say to a great orchestra who have performed that hundreds of times?
Right.
How do you get the orchestra to hear pa-pa-pa-pa and say, hey, that's really good stuff? as opposed to, again, you know, so that's the
four
difference.
Four notes for crying out.
Well, it's my own rendition of what I want to hear.
Now, tell everybody the idea. How did the school start?
It was Toby's idea, my wife Toby's idea. It was her dream because we met in a school, in a summer program.
During Juilliard?
During Juilliard, sure, of course. And so she started this whole thing, you know, and it was actually 25 years ago. So this is our 25th anniversary for the Perlman Music Program. And yes. And it was basically for strings. And I think we had kids come to our house in Long Island and practice scales. And, you know, like at 8 o'clock in the morning, you said, Toby thought that was the greatest alarm clock. But we're now in Shelter Island.
Right. Now, the people, whether it's the young program or the 18 and over program, yeah, are they, is it free of charge and you're raising money to pay for the whole people?
We never refuse for lack of funds. We give a lot of people scholarships
yeah,
and some more, some less, and so on. And some, if they want to pay, they can pay. But it really doesn't matter because, you know, the expense of the program is so that even if we were to charge everybody equally, will still be in the red, severely, yeah, believe me, severely. But it's great. And the program has not grown on purpose. Right. You know, we started with about 38, 39 kids, and we still have 38, 39 kids for the Littles program. And it's amazing. It's very difficult to describe unless you
it
go
is.
There
yeah.
and just well, give the experience. We have kids playing twice a week, works in progress, we call it whips, you know, where they try new pieces in front of an audience and so on. It's great. And I've been, during the summers, I don't play concerts. I just teach there.
Yeah.
And with other great, great faculty. And we have, you know, the philosophy of a lack, once you're in that program, a lack of competition between the kids. You know, they all support each other. And for me, that's so important, you know, that you know, when somebody plays well, they're truly happy for them. And when somebody messes up, they go and they console them and they really feel for them. It's a real family.
Yeah,
it's so important.
It's a great vibe. Itzhak Perlman's wife, Toby Perlman, please come and join us, Toby. And please welcome Rachel Lee Pride and Randall Gooseby. Now, we're going to bring out six other people who've been playing the violin since they were 18 months old. Let's get them out here. And then when we're done performing, we're going to end. We're going to end with this music. Here they come. Great.
Thank you.
That was Itzhak Perlman, his wife and Perlman Music Program founder Toby, and their brilliant violin students Rachel Lee Pryde and Randall Gooseby. The artists who made up the octet were Rachel and Randall, plus Stella Chen and Kenneth Renshaw, also on violin, Chaley Smith and Joshua Kale on viola, Nico Olarte-Hayes and Ichun Su on cello. The piece was The Presto from Mendelssohn's Octet Opus 20 in E-flat major, recorded live at NYU's Skirball Center in Manhattan. And now my conversation with Renee Fleming from 2012. Renee Fleming has a powerful effect on people. Conductor Sir George Scholte described the opera singer's voice as double cream. Garrison Keillor said she made his nostrils twitch. New York chef Daniel Ballou created a signature dessert to honor her. But Renee Fleming is down to earth. When the people's diva, as she's been called, went to Paris to rehearse Handel's Alcina, one of her favorite roles, she spent most of the first week looking for playgrounds for her two young daughters. Renee grew up in Rochester, New York, where both her parents were high school music teachers. During the first 2 years of her life, while in her playpen, Renee would listen while her mother gave singing lessons. A few years later, Renee organized a barbershop trio with her younger sister and brother. One might say Renee Fleming was born into music.
I often refer to myself as an indentured servant because we grew up with it. My parents were both. We all sang all the time. You'd take a family cross-country trip and be singing the road signs and in harmony. And I thought everybody did that. You know, I just thought, oh, this is what families do.
Well, your friends would get in the car with your family and it was like, well, I'm with these crazy Flemings.
Exactly.
Those Flemings, they're...
Yeah,
exactly. They sing to the trees, yeah. And they sing to the exit signs. And
we talked about singing.
Did you feel like this was your way to communicate with your own parents?
Well, interestingly, my dad was a big jazz fan. My mother didn't bring music home much at all. She wanted a break from it when she came home. Other than when we performed, she prepared us. You know, I think her idea was that we would be the next Von Trapps. You know, my father, thank God, put the kibosh on that and said, no, I don't think so.
Let me guess, your mother was the competitive one.
She was very type A. You know, she's Czech, and my grandmother and my aunts were all like this. I mean, they would come over, and the work ethic was unbelievable. I think I work hard. No. They used to look at me and say, you know, Renee, you really need to step it up.
Yeah.
You know? And I see myself doing the same thing with my two daughters, so I sort of can't help it. But the music thing, you know, it was just so natural for us. And my way of rebelling against it was to find my own music. So I became a composer. In middle school, I started writing songs, and then—
You played piano?
I played piano. I played guitar.
And what kind of music did you write? Were you like Joni Mitchell music, or were you
Yeah, it was sort of singer, what we call now singer-songwriter. But I also wrote art songs that I actually notated and wrote out that other people sang. In that time, women weren't particularly encouraged to be composers. In a different setting, that might have been the direction I would have gone in, because I loved it. And it suited my temperament much better than performing. I was so shy. Performing was so far away from who I really was.
A specific opera, the first opera, if you can recall, because I remember the first movie I went to see in a movie theater.
Ah.
What was the first opera that you became aware of?
You know, I would say, gosh, Suor Angelica is what I remember, because my mother performed it, and we were in the first row. And this is the Eastman Theater. So first of all, I was incredibly impressed by the theater. This massive chandelier, you know, all the velvet. I mean, I took up violin because of the velvet in the case. So we were nothing if not superficial, I guess. You know, I didn't really know anything about the story, but she was crying. And she was crying because she was singing about, you know, her dead baby and wanting to be joined with her baby again and just looking at her three children in front of her. Somehow, I think that really impressed me.
Did you ever imagine at that time, I mean, in middle school and you're singing this piece, that that would be a path for you, that you'd end up where you are now?
Gosh, no. Nobody really asked kids in those days, what do you want?
Exactly.
What would you like to do? You just went along.
True.
I know so many people in my generation who applied to three colleges and never gave it much thought and really, you know, the way we raise children now is worlds apart from how we were raised.
How do you feel, we say? How do you feel? My parents couldn't give a damn how I felt.
No.
Really?
The only thing I thought that I wanted to be was the president. So there was a, I'd say a kernel of ambition there.
In the world I was in, it was, you know, doctor, lawyer, or if you were of a more working class background, a job that just gave you security and a pension.
Mm-hmm.
The Long Island Railroad, the police department, the fire department. You know, you learn very quickly to choose from a menu. Actor was not on the menu.
On the menu,
that
right.
That was submitted to me.
Well, I went into music ed, like my parents. So that's another thing you did. You followed your parents because you couldn't think of anything else to do.
Sure.
And then when the singing became more interesting, and particularly jazz, when I really found myself in through singing with it in a club every weekend for 2.5 years. Then my parents got nervous. Oh, it's so hard. It's too competitive.
What happens when you're writing songs, popular music or whatever, you know, you said singer-songwriter, whether it's Carole King or what have you, and you're singing jazz in nightclubs in Rochester? Clubs there?
No, in Potsdam, where I went to undergraduate school.
Is Potsdam a hotbed of jazz
nightclubs? No, it's a college hotbed. And the drinking age was 21. So
clubs?
Yes. So we all spent a lot of time in clubs. And this particular Alger's pub had very high-quality jazz all the time. And the guys that I worked with are all working musicians. It was an extraordinary education for me in many, many ways. I mean, that's how I learned. That's how I was able to embrace performing. Because Illinois Jacquette heard me sing in Potsdam and said, why don't you come on the road? We'll come to New York and really
Illinois
do.
Illinois Jacquette?
Yes. It's a great tenor saxophone player, was really going to put me on the map as a jazz singer, and I just knew I didn't have the courage.
You could have been a popular singer. You could have been, where do you take the term? You're saying, opera is it now. What
you
happened?
You know, had I grown up in New York City, the singer-songwriter thing might have opened, doors might have opened. I mean, I sang on television in high school, winning some talent show, literally playing a song that I wrote. The making the decision to go on into graduate school that sort of solidified my
graduate
path.
School was where?
At Eastman.
So you went,
I went
from
back
Potsdam,
home.
You went back home.
Yeah,
You're still
back home
a little
for
shy.
2 years.
You're still coming out of your shell.
Yeah, then I tried to pursue jazz then, and that didn't work, despite the fact that Eastman had a phenomenal jazz department. I just couldn't get in. I couldn't break in. So, you know, it was really circumstance that pushed me towards classical music, and eventually I really embraced it. And the other thing is I realized it was much more suited to my temperament. I liked being in the practice room. I liked studying. I enjoyed wrestling with this instrument alone.
It was harder.
I don't know that it was harder, but it was more internal kind of cerebral work. You know, the interesting thing about jazz or anything popular, you see, it was very personality driven. And I just didn't have that. I think I do now. Interestingly, I've come out of my shell. I mean, when I tell people I was extremely shy, nobody believes me now.
That's a thing that people have to overcome.
Yes, exactly. You know, I found a lot of comedians to be extraordinarily serious and almost withdrawn sometimes. So, yeah, I think sometimes we overcome things by going after the very thing that really eludes us. So certainly in my case, that was it. I would observe friends who were comfortable at performing, and I would just try to act like them. So that was—
It's interesting you said
that. Worked.
It's an impersonation. Someone said to me, well, how do you perform in the theater? Like, why is the theater so soothing to you? And I say, because I know that for 2.5 hours, I know exactly where I'm going to be, exactly what I'm going to say, exactly what you're going to say, and exactly how a room full of people is going to react to what I say.
Huh. And you don't feel performance pressure? Because I had terrible stage fright.
I do
feel the pressure in rehearsal. I feel the pressure to unearth, to get down to it and get the work done. And if I feel that we got the work done, then it's orgasmic. You know, like I go out there in front of the audience and I'm like, well, how's everybody doing? You know, I'm like, I'm very happy.
Comfortable,
you know,
yeah.
I think they're going to like it.
Right.
But if I go out there and I'm a little bit hesitant because I'm thinking, I don't think we got it. But you do 2 years at Eastman, and you get a graduate degree there. Then what happens?
Then I went to Juilliard. I did postgrad. Listen, I could be a doctor or a lawyer as long as I was in school.
I was going to say, how does that work? Why Juilliard?
Juilliard, at the time, the American Opera Center, so now the Juilliard Opera Center, I believe, it was a postgraduate program. I was cast as Musetta in La Boheme. So I came here to sing a role. You get free lessons, coachings, all of the support that we couldn't otherwise afford. You know, you're a beginner. And I worked in Rockefeller Plaza for a law firm, pay my rent and everything. And it was a great year. It was a phenomenal year.
Did you say to yourself, why didn't I do this sooner?
Yeah, yes, because I was so happy. I mean, I was running around the city like a maniac.
New York is fun.
So active. And then I took a Fulbright grant and studied in Germany, and that was hard.
How long were you there?
A year.
Where in Germany?
In Frankfurt.
How was that?
It was important. It was probably one of the most crucial pieces in my education because it was so challenging, number one. I didn't speak a word of German when I went there. I was in the Hochschule für Musik and was not accepted into the opera department, which was very disappointing to me at the time. I cried the whole way there, literally, sobbing.
Germany.
Yes. And my boyfriend at the time, who became my husband, said, well, you know, don't not go because of me. And I remember thinking, God, that would be the furthest thing from my mind. I was so kind of self-possessed, but also clueless about the choices I was making. That's why I wrote a book for young singers, because if young singers or any one of them like I was, you just don't know what you're getting into. But I was also very lucky because that year turned out to be a very formative experience. I mean, learning to speak fluent German.
How many languages do you speak fluently?
Well, I studied French in high school, like many of us did. That was, you know, the language. Paris is my second home, and I sang there every year for a long time. So my French is, when I'm there, it picks up again, and it's good. But German is even more fluent and consistent.
During that year, you learned to speak it fluently in that 1 year?
Well,
you're forced to?
You know, I love the study of learning and of memory because what I've discovered is that at the end of that year, my German was okay, was good, you know. But every year, every time I go back, it gets better. And I don't have to speak a word of German in between. So the brain, those neurons keep firing.
Then you come back to Juilliard.
Yes, then I come back to Juilliard. I tried to stay in Germany. I tried to stay there and get work. No one would have me. So I came back. And my career started here then.
How?
Well, I had a rough couple of years of sort of no man's land, which is very common with singers between education and the start of career. It's very common for all of us, really, all musicians. You know, and there's this catch-22 where you can't get management unless they can go hear you perform, but you can't get a job
in the acting world.
Okay.
Yeah. Call me when you're in a show.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'll come see you.
That's the manager you're trying to get. So competitions were the thing that helped me. I won the
showcases
competition.
Almost.
Exactly.
In the theater, yeah.
For me, it was the Met competition. I mean, it took me 3 times, but I finally won. All of a sudden, the doors opened. But it took about a year and a half, I'd say. Things went slowly,
steadily. And the first paid, legit, professional job you had was doing what?
The first real engagement was in 1988 in the Houston Grand Opera, and it was Marriage of Figaro. And that really put me on the map.
Right.
And that
Describe
was
that.
So important. I had never sung the opera in Italian. I'd sung it in English. So I went to rehearse with really seasoned professionals. I mean, people who were big opera stars already. And I was a beginner. You know, the first day of rehearsal, Thomas Allen in particular, Sir Thomas Allen, who's got such an intelligence and a sophistication about his portrayal of all of these Mozart heroes. He's still performing, I think, at the Royal Opera. I was just jelly at the end of the first rehearsal because I thought, I can't even keep up with him. Mozart recitative is really hard. Imagine doing very quick dialogue in a foreign language that you don't speak, really. And I learned, you know, when you're young, you just learn.
You're doing because
you
you're
do what
thinking.
You have to do, yeah, to keep up.
I lifted the car off my baby because I had to lift the car
exactly.
off my baby to save my baby.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you get these opportunities, you have to rise to the occasion and take a risk and get out there and really make it work, or you don't get the opportunity again. You know, it's so competitive, the field. I think all my horseback riding and doing horse shows as a kid really prepared me for that.
And when the curtain, I don't mean to be so melodramatic, but the world you live in kind of lends itself to this. When the curtain comes down and the first show is over, how did you feel?
Well, you know, it's unfortunately too long ago for me to remotely remember that. But, you know, I can tell you there was a euphoria in those early experiences, a sense of happiness and relief when I would go from one engagement to the other. You know, our world, we never stop. So there's no sort of, you do a project and then you take a break.
It's all a big blur.
It's just, after that, it's a blur.
Yeah, and I say that to people. I say it's like it's all one big episode of a TV show to me now. Two things. One is more tangible than the other. Someone, Melanie Griffith, years ago said to me that every role you play is the chance to bury that part of yourself that you don't like. And the other thing I find is that when God wants to make fun of me and to mock me, I'll get a script, and what's going on with that character is exactly what's going on in my life.
Right, yes.
And I'll read the script, and it's almost God is saying to me, see? See how stupid it looks when it's on paper?
I have felt that a lot of times when I've been in any kind of conflict or struggle. Somehow the repertoire that I'm performing has just coincidentally mirrored it in a way that's been healing. Let's say healing.
Dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off. Starts Friday and open Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, today with Renee Fleming. In your work, because in my work it's not this way, you can't do what you do unless you summon up some reservoir of the deepest, deepest passion to sing these roles effectively. But think of a role you've performed where even you sat there and go, God, this is killing me.
Well,
it came out of you like you couldn't believe it came out of you.
You know, there are two sides of it. One is the vocal. One is this feeling that, you know, I'm in the right place at the right time to be singing this. And you know,
what's
the
one
voice.
Of those?
Well, the voice is such an evolving instrument. So when I sang Thais, for instance, at the Met some years ago and had these spectacular costumes from Christian Lacroix, you just thought the stars have aligned. to make this role suit me perfectly right now. I love singing in French. I love Massenet, the way it lies, the character, the fact that, you know, the psychological drama in this opera where these two people completely change places with each other. That was a case certainly where I just thought, you know, and I was going to do it again. And somebody stopped and said, do you want to sing it again in 5 years if it's not as good as it was this time? And I said, you're right. I'm not going to.
You felt it was
I'm
good.
Not going to risk that.
You enjoyed it.
Oh, it was perfect. I mean, I couldn't do it better. So it's not very often I can say that. I couldn't do it better. Someone else maybe could do
sure.
it better.
Different.
It was the best that I could
different.
Do.
How have opera audiences changed during your career? If at all.
I think the challenge we face in opera in general, and I would say forget opera, in classical music, is really exposure. It used to be that we had exposure, obviously, in schools. We had exposure through churches and through our families. Every socially climbing family got a piano and felt that a musical education was part, or an arts education was part of their children's, you know, the betterment of their lives. And that, you know, it is what it is. It is gone. It's just simply people don't feel it's relevant anymore.
That breaks my heart when you say that, but it's true. When you do a show, when you're performing a piece, what's the day like for you? You go to the theater,
mm-hmm.
and do you have do people in your field, do you have like a warm-up you do? Is there a...
Well,
I know nothing about that.
I try to vocalize earlier in the day because I find that it's better for me a little bit, just to kind of see where it's at.
You
know,
avoid
some
eating
days,
certain things, drinking certain things. I mean,
I have to be careful about, I love caffeine. You know, I would drink coffee all day, and I have to be careful about that because it's dehydrating. So I'll have my typical, you have to force fluids a little bit, which I hate too. So these are the boring things.
Well, but not really, because people I think are just interested in what kind of the discipline. It's complex.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most people can't control what they eat and drink.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, having the humidifier on, making sure it's a lot about, you know, moisture. These are all mucous membranes. The vocal folds are very sensitive, and you want to go into that performance with them being super healthy and not dried out. We're the Olympians of singers, really. You'll have a 3 to 5 hour long performance. And yeah. That takes a lot of physical stamina.
You're not at Feinstein's for an
hour. it's a lot of physical stamina. Plus, you're emotionally all over the place.
Sure.
You know, as you said,
I
it's a very...
Imagine.
But it's mainly the amount of sound we have to produce to be heard over the orchestra and the chorus in a huge hall. That's the thing that is different. And if we sing well, if we sing technically well, we should be able to get up the next day and sound normal. You know, people go to sports events and scream at, you know, the other team or even the people they like, and they're hoarse the next day. We can't do that. We're doing the same thing, but we're doing it in a trained way. And, you know, it is a hard art form to get right. There are all these elements, and it's live. But when it's right, it's amazing.
Renee Fleming says she's looking forward to getting some rest, although it's not clear when that will come. In addition to her busy performance schedule, she recently became the creative consultant for the Lyric Opera in Chicago. They just announced an upcoming world premiere opera based on the bestseller Bel Canto, and she's been advocating for more arts education in schools.
It's not just for people to be consumers of the arts, it's for them to also participate, find their creative voices, and build confidence through participation.
Oh.
My thanks to Itzhak Perlman and Renee Fleming. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.